oversized jeans, and tough accent got me labeled as hard. So again, I went underground, this time by easing out of who I'd always known myself to be and toward an apparently more digestible version. I traded the full head of chunky braids for cornrows in the front and hair down in the back. I changed how I spoke and eventually even found my way into some dresses. A lot of these changes were a natural evolution, just part of exploring and experimenting with different looks and growing into my full womanhood. But behind the shifting wardrobe, beyond the softening around the edges, there lurked a message. You are not sufficient as you are. My industry reinforced that message. For every performance, every photo shoot and appearance, there's an expectation of female flawlessness. Ahead of each event comes hair and makeup, and I'm not talking about some light dust of powder. It's the works. Heavy foundation, fake eyelashes and liner, 3 coats of mascara and lipstick. Creating this impenetrable armor of perfection is literally an hours-long production. And for my first 15 years in music, I went through it nearly every day. The makeup would sit on my face for 10, 12 hours at a time, often under hot stage lights, always settling into every crevice of my face to clog my pores and lead to breakouts. My skin couldn't breathe. In time, nor could I. When I'd come home from whatever event I'd had, I'd scrub off all that foundation, rip off the eyelashes, pull out my fake ponytail extension, and stare at my bare skin. Without the makeup, I no longer even recognized myself. My anxiety over appearance also invaded my private world. Any mother can tell you that after having a couple of babies, it takes frickin' forever for your body to recover. In some ways, it never fully does. For months after you give birth, you're like, what happened? And how come I'm not bouncing back? Add to that having others seemingly fixated on every ripple of my skin, every hint of cellulite. While on vacation, I'd play on the beach with Egypt as some long lens camera swooped in to capture a close-up of my abs. I'd find myself holding in my stomach, praying the images wouldn't end up on some blog and go viral. They usually did. And though I know it's a fact of life in my industry, it still felt mean and intrusive. Nobody is supposed to snap a picture of somebody's butt on the beach and then circulate that photo en masse. It's not natural. In fact, it's cruel. Meanwhile, because every model in every magazine spread is airbrushed to death, no one recalls what cellulite actually looks like. Women have loose flesh and stretch marks. That is the truth. And yet it's the lie, the unattainable standard that is peddled in its place. We've been sold this lie so frequently that it has altered our very way of seeing. That head trip is what led me to think twice about doing what mothers all over the world do every single day, leaving the house without makeup and in sweats to pick up my child from school. On those occasions when I did roll out with a bare face and a baseball cap, I often declined to take photos with those who asked. When I'd reluctantly agree, mostly because I didn't want to disappoint someone with a sweet spirit, I'd freak out for hours afterward. What if the picture gets put up on Instagram? There were only 2 options for breaking out of my prison. To always leave my house ready for a close-up, which every parent can testify is impossible. Or to finally get comfortable with my true face. Others' opinions be damned. On that Sunday in Turks, when I sat scribbling my soul onto paper, I chose door 2. My slow walk to freedom, which began as a flurry of painful and disjointed thoughts, eventually morphed into a published letter, one that inspired a viral moment. The universe brought me yet another chance to uncover, this one in the context of family blending. My sons were born into a blessing, a loving tribe of siblings, all of whom have embraced their younger brothers. Swiss is the father of five. His eldest son, Nasir, a college student who's also an artist, writer, and producer. His daughter, Nicole, born in 2008 and living in London. Kasim Jr., a.k.a. KJ, the son he and his first wife, Mashonda, welcomed in 2006. And, of course, Egypt and Genesis. Swiss steps up for every one of his children. As a father, he is engaged and committed beyond providing financially. He comes from a line of good men who, though human and flawed as we all are, still lovingly coached and guided him toward manhood. We are intent on building that same foundation for our five. Nicole spends time with us over summer breaks and holidays, and we stay in touch with her throughout the year. KJ, who lives close by, is with us consistently, and Nas is in New York for college. Our family has become the definition of a successful blend. When you love someone, you love their journey, and that path leads you to the family dynamic you were meant to inherit and devote yourself to. Through my own childhood experience, I know how often we're taught what a family should look like. And if your family doesn't look like what we've been shown, we somehow feel incomplete. But really, families come in all versions, shapes, and sizes, and should be celebrated as part of our collective experience. That is what life has taught me. Blending a family isn't always high fives and hugs. The process of coming together has involved unmasking ourselves, a peeling back of layers to reveal our deep personal truths. It has meant engaging in awkward conversations. It has involved spending time to truly hear one another's viewpoints and then finding a place to understand one another. That has had to happen with our entire family. That willingness to hear and empathize has been the starting point for creating a healthy environment. We're constantly working on getting it right. One profound moment of this came the first time Mashonda and I connected over dinner. By this time, little KJ and I had already become close during his frequent visits to our home. Mashonda and I met in the private downstairs cellar at Philip Marie, a cozy Italian spot in downtown Manhattan. Once we got beyond a few pleasantries and toasted our meeting, silence set in. I could feel the guardedness in both of us. And yet, as much as there was to say, we didn't get too deep that evening. We had easy, fluid conversation. Toward the end, Mashonda made a comment that really struck me. "One day," she said, "we're going to share grandchildren." She was right. Through the powerful connection of our shared son, KJ, we'd be connected for life. One day, if KJ marries, she and I will be fussing over him and his partner, wanting every detail to be perfect. One day, Mashonda and I might both hold a small baby who is KJ's child. That baby will have three grandmothers, and I will be one of them. There is no writing each other off when love is involved. It's all about finding a way through. That first conversation was a start and a way for us to dip our toes into the waters of a real connection. Not long after that first dinner, Swiss, Mashonda, and I also began meeting regularly, just the three of us. When you come together for the first time trying to blend a family, it can be tough. There was a lot of talking over one another. I walked out of there thinking, if we're going to make this work, we've got to find a way to do it differently. We eventually did. One evening I said to Erica, "How do you get people to actually hear one another?" She mentioned the idea of active listening, of having all parties agree, among other things, to hear one another without interrupting. You can't truly listen when you're constantly cutting someone off or already formulating a response in your head as he or she speaks. She'd seen the tool work for others, and it sounded like it could be of value in our process, so I brought it into our next roundtable. I led us in an opening prayer. As we held hands, I asked that we reveal our highest selves and feel protected during the conversation. Let's create some ground rules, I suggested. Rule one, this was a safe space where anything could be expressed, but it had to be said with respect and love. Rule two, absolutely no interrupting. Even if we heard something we totally disagreed with, we had to let the speaker complete his or her thought. If something came to mind while someone else spoke, we'd write it down and then wait to speak about it until it was our turn. Rule three, after one of us spoke, the others had to later repeat back to that person what they thought was said. As in, I heard you say X. That gave us the opportunity to be clear, to either say, yes, that is exactly what I meant, or no, that's not it. We went around the table, one by one, over several hours, and spoke our truths. Without all the interruptions, the vibe was calm. We didn't always like or agree with what each of us had to say, but for the first time, we fully took it in. It was the beginning of the openness we share to this day. It was not until I became a mother that I truly understood the nature of selfless love. A care so profound that I'd do anything to protect our children. And because of my own upbringing, I know how important it is for all of our children to feel connected to their father. I know what it feels like to not have your dad around every day. It's one reason why I work extra hard to bring us all together. It's why I'm often up at 2 a.m., arranging schedules and pickups, vacation times and family gatherings and joint parent-teacher conferences, or preparing to welcome Nicole and Nas into town for Thanksgiving or Christmas celebrations. It's why I'll help KJ with school projects and read with him before bed. It's why, even when I'm overwhelmed after a tour or have all the kids on my own while Swiss is traveling, I find joy in caring for our children. I know they are feeling consistently loved, and I'm a big part of why they feel that way. When KJ was little, he started referring to me as his stepmom, which didn't feel like the right vibe to me, especially when Egypt began mimicking KJ and also calling me stepmom. So Swiss and I came up with an alternative. KJ would call me Umi, a beautiful word that means mother in Arabic. Egypt and Genesis now also call me Umi in addition to mommy. Umi is one of my favorite words and identities. And being Umi to a wide age range of children also gives me parental foresight. By walking alongside a 13-year-old KJ, I get a peek at what may be ahead for 9-year-old Egypt. It's a real-life practice run. And Nas, who is navigating early adulthood, has his own unique relationship with me, given that I'm not his biological parent. There's a freedom and honesty in our connection, and I want to create that same safe space for my other children in the years ahead. I'll always remember how KJ's eyes brightened when he first saw the video for Blended Family, a song I'd begun work on even before I found out I was pregnant with Genesis. The video includes several modern families, all whom have blended in some way. Our own beautiful blended family is featured. A$AP Rocky, the rapper and actor, also has a cameo. He has a blended family too, KJ said. I nodded and smiled, thrilled that he'd grasped the message. Blending is not an exception, but a sweet commonality, one we share with the millions of families who've joined hands and linked hearts. What has happened in our home is proof that blending and being willing to connect on a real level can bring about a stronger family foundation. Our family gatherings no longer have to be so structured or scheduled. We've eased into a rhythm that has us frequently in each other's homes and lives. For a recent weekend with KJ, for instance, I picked him up from school on a Thursday so he could be with us until Monday. Monday turned out to be a snow day, as in no school, much to the joy of our boys. so KJ spent the day with his brothers. That evening, while I was at the studio, Mashonda stopped by to pick up KJ. He, Egypt, and Genesis were in the middle of dinner, so she pulled up a chair and hung with them. She has her own relationship with our boys, independent of Swiss and me, and she sometimes even picks up Genesis from school, as well as brings the boys little gifts. None of this has to be planned. The blending, at this point, is fluid, relaxed, and second nature. Blending is about more than bringing together families. You and I blend every time we have a conversation with someone who doesn't think like us, talk like us, look like us, or share our religious and political beliefs with respect. We blend when we initiate a compassionate dialogue with someone we've had a disagreement with. We blend when we set aside our own ego and agenda and consider an experience through another person's lens. We blend when we elevate a relationship with time and kind words. That is what it truly means to come together, not just to hear, but to listen with an open heart. When Swiss and I returned from Turks, I began finalizing work on Here. Most of the songs had been completed the year before. A few new ones were added. The promotional photo shoots were arranged ahead of the release of the first single, In Common, and for that session, I arrived at the studio straight from the gym. My face was bare, without even a hint of chapstick. I was dressed in a loose sweatshirt. My hair was still stuffed under a scarf and a baseball cap. "I have to shoot you right now, like this," said Paola, this incredible photographer I'd worked with before. I froze. "Now? Looking like this?" Paola and my then creative director, Earl Sebastian, had been brainstorming with me about how we could capture the rawness of me and my music. But I still needed a few minutes to wrap my head around this particular idea. They gave me a minute to let it settle in, and I finally agreed. Before long, Paola was clicking away. I held my breath for the first full 5 minutes of that shoot. That's how nervous and insecure I felt about being photographed in my most plain state. Though for months I'd been thinking through and journaling about how frustrated I was with society's oppressive expectations for women and how ready I felt to reveal my true face, that was all theoretical until the moment I was confronted with the lens of a camera. And honestly, it frightened me. I told the universe I wanted authenticity, and the universe had answered in the way that it does. It sent me a test, a way to practice that visual honesty. And initially, I wasn't quite ready for that test. As Paola clicked away, a single thought raced through my brain. Am I actually doing this? And then, as the session progressed, I started relaxing. Click by click, frame by frame, against a plain white background, I dropped my shoulders and just leaned into the experience. Halfway through, I even started to enjoy it. I look now at the photos from that series with my scarf tied into a top knot and my spirit as open as my expression. And you know what? I know who that girl is. That whole scene is totally my world, my vibe and energy. That's how I rock. And it flowed from a place that could not be more organic. It came from the freedom I've been reaching for all my life. It came from my willingness to, at last, show my unretouched, imperfect, and uncensored face. That photo shoot, along with my journal entry in Turks, are what prompted me to write Time to Uncover as a piece for Lenny Letter, the feminist forum created by Lena Dunham and Jenny Connor. I'd been inspired and moved by some of the other Lenny letters I'd read, so I gathered the raw pieces from my diary pages and turned that into a first draft. When I showed it to my husband, he said, "Really? You feel this way?" I did. And in May 2016, when the letter was published, a couple of the most honest lines I'd written made it into the piece. "I don't want to cover up anymore," I wrote. not my face, not my mind, not my soul, not my dreams, not my struggles, not my emotional growth, nothing. I still feel exactly that way. The same month the letter was published, the barefaced images from the In Common photo series were released. The response to both the letter and the photos was unbelievable to me, even now. On social media, tens of thousands of people began posting images of their own faces with the hashtag #NoMakeup. It became a cultural light bulb so strong that it outshined everything, including, at times, the music itself. The message resonated across socioeconomic and generational lines. Even those I never would have expected to be following me were clearly paying attention. Many fathers came up to me and said, "Love that no makeup thing you're doing, it's beautiful. I have daughters, and it's exactly what I want them to hear." Women and girls posted entries about how empowered they felt to go natural. On Snapchat, Gabrielle Union put up an image of herself complete with her gorgeous freckles and a headscarf and captioned it, "No makeup, head wrap, hey Alicia Keys, I see you." And Kim Kardashian rocked the no makeup look at the Balenciaga fashion show in Paris. In hindsight, there's one small thing I would have changed about my letter. Toward the end of the piece I wrote, "I hope to God it's a revolution." If I had to do it over, I would have clarified that idea by inserting the word personal in front of the word revolution, because that's actually what I meant. The reaction to my letter was overwhelmingly positive, and yet there were those who interpreted it as a public campaign rather than as one woman's manifesto. "Well, if I look like you," someone wrote, "I could choose not to wear makeup too." I responded at the time the way I do today. My deepest intention is that we all find a path to whatever freedom feels like for us. And that is unique to each person. I still wear makeup when I feel like it, though less of it. And I still enjoy experimenting with a new shade of lipstick or eyeshadow. The point is that I, and everyone else, have a choice. And we should be able to freely make that choice from one moment to the next without society's standard of beauty hovering over us. I am my own standard bearer. So are you. The vast majority of the people who read my letter embraced the spirit of it. A lot of us are over the fakeness. Much of what we see and consume in our world is so carefully constructed and polished, so highly curated. Like never before, we crave the authentic, not just when it comes to appearance, but also in our narratives, in our conversations, in our work and political spheres, in our friendships and intimate relationships. And as we uncover that truth, as we remove the masks and falsehoods, and finally get clear on what's real, the work of our lives, as I see it, is to stand immovably in that truth. Chapter 17, Crossroads. I'm blessed with so many creative friendships. Here's my ally, sister, and fellow activist, America Ferrera.
Alicia and I met just as the Time's Up movement was coming together and women in entertainment were convening in an unprecedented way. She reached out to me to talk about how women in the music industry could be included in that conversation, in that community of artists. We really connected over a shared desire for sisterhood in our social justice work. What I love about Alicia is that she's a woman of her word. When we make plans to organize around an issue we care about, be it for a march in DC or a voter registration rally, Alicia shows up. There isn't a lot of hemming and hawing, it's action. Ahead of the Families Belong Together March in 2018, I just had a baby and was breastfeeding every couple of hours. But I've got to figure out how to be a part of this solidarity, I told Alicia. I'll be there with you, she said. And she was. She and her son Egypt were on a 6 a.m. train with me from New York City to Washington, D.C. She shows up not only physically, but with her whole heart and soul. I've learned so much from her about the power of being a fully embodied and present woman.
Aside from my soulmate connection with Swiss and my infinite love for my children, I've had three mountaintop moments during my career as an artist. Experiences so epic, so transcendent, that they raised the tiny hairs on my skin and kept them in salute. One was the Legends Weekend with Oprah, that intersection of past and present and its sheer spirit power. I left Oprah's house with my hand over my heart and a desire to walk taller and dream bigger. Another was the lunch my brother Bono and I shared with President Obama in the Oval Office. And the most monumental experience, at least up till now, taking over Times Square to perform live on John Lennon's birthday. A year ahead of the November 2016 release of Here, the seed for the idea was planted. Why not put on a live show in the city that gave me wings? A concert during a time when our culture is at a crossroads. It was the perfect intersection of art and activism. I'd serve up a taste of 15 songs, some old, some new, many love letters to my hometown, while standing for peace and nonviolent protest in celebration of a legend who embodied both. From the beginning, my intention was to do more than deliver a concert. It was to use this platform, this unique moment in history, amid the most intense presidential campaign in decades, to shine a light. And what better place to lift a lantern than on the nation's epicenter, a concrete jungle that 50 million souls pass through annually and millions more are inspired by. That hub, the home of the brave and the birthplace of hip-hop, just so happened to include the 5-block radius where I first learned my music lessons and dreamed my dreams, where the smells, the sea of yellow taxis, the yelling and the honking, the magic and the music made me who I am. We'd keep the free concert a secret, revealing the details bit by bit on social media. First the date, Sunday, October 9th, and then the time. 8 p.m. And finally, the exact location. That's how Here in Times Square began, as a vision for the ultimate NYC block party. The journey to my backyard was not without its challenges. With an album's release date already in cement, my team worked backward from that date when scheduling the concert. Such an enormous endeavor comes at a steep price, so we sought out major partnerships on multiple levels to help defray the expense. Trouble is, before we could lock down all those alliances, upfront costs began mounting. As the concert date inched closer, my organization had spent a couple $100,000 on hiring people to create footage and transfer that footage onto the 15 or 20 jumbo electronic billboard screens we'd use during the event. And yet the experience turned out to be so priceless, so worth every dime spent. On the morning of the concert, my team spread out over the 57th floor of the W Hotel at 47th and Broadway. Close to the northern part of the square where the stage was set, and near the famous TKTS booth. There was a sound check 2 hours beforehand. I walked from my hotel over to the stage entrance, balancing a cup of coffee while gazing up at a sight that in a zillion years I'd never would have thought I'd witness. Row after row of massive screens flashing Alicia Here in Times Square, with images of my various album covers alternating with beautiful messages like peace and imagine. In the lead up to the event, I'd seen the blueprints. I'd sat in on our meetings I'd heard the details. I created the vision. I spoke of what I wanted, and we went through many incarnations of these ideas. And yet none of it came close to the amazement I felt as I stared up, taking in the moment. Near the iconic NASDAQ sign, thousands were already gathering along the sidewalks of my old hood for a secret that was now definitely out. NYPD officers closed off surrounding streets. Traffic was rerouted. One of the world's busiest intersections was slowing to a halt for me to perform my songs. I've dreamed a lot of big dreams over the years, but never in my wildest fantasies had I envisioned this. My astonishment continued as I peered around the square. On one corner was the little bodega where I used to get my fake IDs. On another was the city bus stop where I'd wait for rides in the biting cold. Around the corner stood the two mighty towers where my childhood played out in a tiny living room divided by an upright. And down the street near 48th and 9th was the performing arts school where I harmonized and improvised and studied the work of musical giants. Can you imagine returning to the neighborhood where you grew up and then having 15,000 people meet you outside on the corner? It felt so otherworldly to me that during the sound check, I held back tears. There I stood, 15 years after Songs in A Minor hit, ready to share music from 6 albums. Later, just before I walked onto the stage for the concert, I prayed with my team, asking the spirit to flow through all of us. Then, just as I went out to meet the crowd, I asked myself the question I ask before every performance. Do you want to be good, or do you want to be great? I answered by bringing my full self to that experience over the next hour and a half. From the opening note of the gospel to the mix of Holy War with Lennon's Imagine, I literally felt like I was floating, elevated by the crowd's energy, filled with the thankfulness for the moment. My team purposely hadn't enclosed the stage. No roof to raise, no ceiling to break through. Out in the open air, I wanted to give those gathered a sense of limitlessness, of never-ending possibilities, of a 360-degree immersive experience that stretched beyond the skyscrapers and up toward heaven. I stood at the Yamaha piano, roaming freely between there and the front of the stage rather than sitting, my new way of performing so I'm not held back. And between the songs, I sprinkled in a few rousing encouragements. "They know that our voice means change," I shouted. "If you care about your life, where we are going, and your children, then vote for it, please." Before the opening notes of She Don't Really Care, I set the mood for a surprise. "I think I need to call my brother real quick," I said into the mic. A dial tone came over the loudspeaker. "Hello," said Q-Tip. Moments later, my boy slid out on stage to perform alongside me. That was just the beginning. Nas joined me for One Love. John Mayer rocked the show with a blend of his gravity with my If I Ain't Got You, while Questlove gifted us with his drum beats. And with each selection, footage orchestrated to match the music flooded the screens. The crowd lost its mind when Jay-Z rolled out, seemingly from nowhere, to drop his rhymes on Empire. Meanwhile, I was on level 1 billion. My arms up, the wind having its way with my fro, my bare face covered in bliss, an electric current vibrating through my body. From the stage, I spotted my sons KJ, Egypt, and Genesis pointing up at the screens, surprised to see their Umi's name in neon lights as I sang Blended Family. "I love you with all my heart," I said as the concert wrapped up. If I'd had my way, I would have stayed out there all night. but the NYPD had other plans. When I was 15 minutes overtime, they began urging me off. I got in one last declaration before they were about to cut me off. Let's rise up and shine up. Through that entire concert, I felt like I was about to faint. And when I made my way backstage, I nearly did. I have seldom been more dizzy with joy. If this was my last day on Earth, I'd be straight, I said to my crew backstage. I mean, I'm not saying I want to die, but man, if it happened that night, what a hell of a way to go. As thousands dispersed, many heading toward the 42nd Street train stop, the screens overhead proclaimed the world as I dream it. Sexism is over. AIDS is over. Violence is over. Refugees welcome. May it one day be so. A month after that concert and 4 days before Americans went to the polls, here hit the airwaves. I'd brainstormed a whole list of more complicated titles before choosing that one. Here says exactly what I intended to say. Let's be present. Let's be right here in our experience, taking in every goosebump and gift. Let's live our lives more aware and awake to both ourselves and the surrounding world. Never before have we needed to be so tuned in to what's happening on the planet, or more clear about how we'll interact with the energy of our times. I now live in woke mode. For me, every moment is a reawakening, a chance to meet myself exactly as I am. I'm finally allowing myself to just be. Be giddy, be irritable, be vulnerable, be silly, be exhilarated, be whomever and however I am. That is my practice, my daily meditation. It's also my daily prayer for all of us, that we allow others the same freedom of expression that we are learning to grant ourselves. A few weeks before the presidential election, Swiss was away at Harvard for one of his 3-week intensives. Between two of his early classes, he called me one morning. "Babe, he's gonna win," he said. "What?" I said. "Trump is going to be president." "What are you talking about, Swiss?" I said. "Never say that. Hell no." For the first time, he said, "I see how it's possible." In class that day, his professor had asked for a show of hands, who's voting for Trump? In a room filled with more than 200 students from all over the world, 90% had lifted their arms. The question was obviously theoretical for the foreign students in the room. Even still, Swiss took note of the shocking number of hands in the air, some of them white, some of them black or brown, all of them representing various demographics. "There were hands raised that I never would have thought would go up," he said. "I'm telling you, he's going to win." There is no denial more deep than the one I was in. Surely Americans will vote with some sense, I thought. Surely the Access Hollywood tape, which hit the headlines 2 days before my Times Square concert, would deliver a knockout blow to the Trump campaign. How could someone who joked about grabbing a woman by her genitals ever be considered fit for the highest office in the land? In my mind, there was no way he could win, and certainly not against a candidate who'd spent her life in public service. That July, 2 weeks after Bernie Sanders conceded, I had taken the stage at the Democratic National Convention in Philly and supported Hillary Clinton, doing all I could through music to heal the divided party. We couldn't allow anger or apathy to keep us home. Seldom had there been someone with a stronger track record of service to run for the presidency. I trusted that Hillary would keep the issues I cared most about in the spotlight. I also trusted her finger on that nuclear button. But Trump? Compulsive, unhinged, dishonest. A man who spent years pouring gas on the birther conspiracy, questioning whether President Obama was even an American. a candidate who played to our nation's long-held racial fears, sending out dog whistles to stir animosity. That man? No way on planet Earth. And yet, on November 8th, the Electoral College cleared its throat and answered otherwise. What a deafening wake-up call. On that Wednesday morning, I was traumatized. My family and friends were also distraught. A lot of my social media fam joined me in that feeling. Thousands voiced anxiety about what this would mean for our nation and world, and many more were as stunned at the outcome as I was. As I moved through that day, the air literally felt different to me, as if the molecules had somehow been rearranged. It's like going to bed knowing the sky is blue and waking up to find it a permanent shade of piss yellow. It's disorienting, like, wait, what just happened? Post-election, nothing seemed normal or felt right. And for me, the biggest travesty was that more than 100 million of us did not vote. Had even a small percentage of those people shown up at the polls, it might have changed the results. The 24/7 news cycle, which was already moving at a head-spinning speed, somehow got faster. When I look back on that time, it astounds me how much change has happened so quickly. How a ticker tape of events consumed us overnight. The 45th president was sworn in that January, delivering a speech that set the tone for what was to come. The next day, more than 3 million protesters in cities across the U.S. and thousands more around the world gathered for the Women's March, the largest single-day protest in U.S. history. At the D.C. demonstration, I sang my heart out on behalf of Girls on Fire everywhere and delivered lines from Maya Angelou's poem, Still I Rise. And in a span of time that now feels more like a decade than a few years, the headlines just kept coming. The culture quake shook more than the political landscape. The Harvey Weinstein story broke around the time of the election, with Ashley Judd taking on the then most influential man in Hollywood. Dozens of others caught the spirit of her bravery and admitted that they'd also been sexually assaulted. The aftershocks reverberated through Hollywood and well beyond as one by one, women and some men raised their hands and said, "Me too," using the phrase Tarana Burke coined in 2006. The steady stream of women, 60 in total, accusing Bill Cosby of sexual misconduct, stepped forward. And on the heels of more heartbreaking killings of unarmed African Americans, including hundreds whose names never made the headlines, Black Lives Matter leaders shifted into sixth gear and stayed there. In 2016, We Are Here met them on the front lines by releasing a video that still gives me chills, even as it breaks my heart. 23 ways you could be killed if you're Black in America. Every other week, there seemed to be another Black person's life unjustly snatched away, and so many of us were asking ourselves, what can we do? This video was one small answer. I personally reached out to some of the individuals who appeared in the video. Lee Blake, who'd first asked me to read all 23 ways myself, and then came up with the brilliant idea for us to expand the circle of those involved when I wasn't feeling that approach, called on several others she knew. There was no glam, no expensive photo shoot costs, just raw and immediate footage, with each of us filming ourselves on a cell phone. One by one, we delivered the list of senseless ways that African Americans can be killed, which includes failing to signal a lane change, Sandra Bland, riding in a car with your girlfriend's child in the back seat, Philando Castile, wearing a hoodie, Trayvon Martin, and selling CDs outside of a supermarket, Alton Sterling. My husband, Swiss, as well as my friends Bono, Beyonce, Janelle Monáe, Taraji P. Henson, Queen Latifah, Chris Rock, Rihanna, Lenny Kravitz, Pharrell, and many others shared their voices alongside mine. Music is one of the most potent forms of protest, the gateway to connection. Seldom has there been a more important time to raise consciousness and shift conversations by picking up a mic. A song, at its core, is a testimony. It's how we tell our stories, both individually and collectively. It's how we forget our troubles for a time and how we remember who we are emotionally. It's how we rally and how we heal. A song, like no other art form, has the ability to curl up inside of our spirits and never move out. I may have become fluent in the language of social justice, but music will always be my mother tongue, my native language, my way of reaching a world that can never have too many songs in it. It was in that spirit that I served as a coach on 3 seasons of The Voice, an NBC show giving new artists, potential trailblazers, in my view, a special platform to hone their craft. One of the coolest things about the show is its defining feature, blind auditions. A row of coaches during my last season in 2018, that was Kelly Clarkson, Adam Levine, Blake Shelton, and me, sit with chairs turned away from the stage as a contestant launches into a song. During the performance, the second you hear something you vibe with, boom, you press your button and swivel around to see the artist. The singer and the coach then form a team. If more than one coach chooses a singer, that singer gets to decide which mentor to team up with. Teams of artists are guided behind the scenes by the coaches, my favorite part, and light up the stage with weekly performances, my other favorite part. And of course, America gets to vote for the singers who most inspire them. It all leads to a final round of performances and one triumphant singer hailed as The Voice. Shout out to my season 12 winner, Chris Blue. During the blind auditions, I listen with my heart because I can feel the intersection of natural talent and soulful expression. When that happens, it sounds like a resounding yes. Even still, I'm sometimes surprised to discover, after I swivel around, that a 16-year-old powerhouse sounds more like an old-school crooner, which is exactly what many listeners thought when they first heard Fallen on the radio. It is a gift to watch artists blossom week by week as they work to implement your suggestions and feedback. As a coach, you're not there to be a judge, a critic, or a commentator. You're there to elevate emerging talent. From the very start of the show back in 2011, I've been invited to be a coach. For a long time, I declined because it didn't feel like quite my zone. But as I began stepping into my full self, living in a more awakened space, I wanted to share some of that energy, that consciousness, both with the contestants and the viewers. In order to reach the people you most want to reach, you sometimes have to go places you wouldn't normally go. The whole reason to be on the show for me is to have a hand in discovering and nurturing these musicians. It's also about widening the spectrum of artistic expression by putting a variety of artists at center stage. Christiana Danielle, one of my singers on season 14, is a perfect example. She is this stunning dark chocolate brown woman who oozes individuality. She wore her fashions and sang her songs with flair, all on her own terms. She was bright and glittery and vocally gifted. She was capable of shining under pressure, and she was the type of unique artist that, in my view, America doesn't see enough of. If the full range of our world's talent and beauty were more often featured, we'd realize just how many choices and voices and styles and sizes there are to celebrate. And maybe then we would break out of these straitjackets, these boxes, these stereotypes, and embrace our true identities. I had more fun on The Voice than I ever expected to. Being on the show gave me a chance to just play, to refuel myself in the middle of all that was happening in the world. A couple of my castmates are also my friends away from the set, Miley Cyrus and Gwen Stefani. So coming to work during those seasons was like hanging out with my girls all evening. Even before I took the stage on the Los Angeles set, I was cracking up behind the scenes with the other coaches. The set itself just pulsates with energy. The joking between us is genuine. That kind of fondness, or at times biting humor, cannot be faked. Even when the cameras aren't rolling, we're often ragging on each other. Adam, who, along with Blake Shelton, has been on the show the longest, is like the granddaddy of coaches. He's playful, but don't get it twisted. He's also super competitive, as we all are. One of the funniest offset moments came in 2017. While preparing for that night's show, Adam Levine noticed me putting on makeup. "I thought you didn't wear makeup," he teased. I stared at him, half grinning, but completely serious when I replied, "I do what the fuck I want." Adam just walked away, smiling and shaking his head, and I kept right on rocking things my way, on stage, off stage, in life. After the election shook the country to its core, I got numb. And then I got busy. What's true about a personal crisis applies to a national one. It rattles you awake. So after a week of grieving, I pushed past my despair and laced up my work boots. The momentum was strong. Millions who were as dumbfounded as I'd been by the results were suddenly passionate about organizing. What we'd always regarded as important now felt downright urgent. It was time to regroup and join forces across all corners of society during this abrupt shift in our times. The suddenness of the change is why, at the start of 2017, I began a transition away from my work on We Are Here. During 3 years, the organization had raised both awareness and millions, and those efforts continue through the nonprofits we put in the spotlight. Yet the strong political headwinds thrust me toward a pressing desire: creating sustainable change as part of a nationwide community of leaders. I recognize that we can get the most done when we strive in unison. That's what first led me to reach out to America Ferrera, aka Firecracker Number One, toward the end of 2017. In the throes of the Weinstein uproar, she and dozens of women in Hollywood, as part of the Time's Up movement, were gathering for closed-door conversations about restoring women's power in the workplace and beyond. My girl Janelle Monáe and I showed up to a meeting in Los Angeles with the intent of trading ideas and then working to bring change in the music industry. While there's some overlap between the Grammy and Oscar worlds, the two industries are vastly different. What works to bring about change in the film and stage business doesn't necessarily translate to the music world. But it was an inspiring starting point, and once back home in New York, I began brainstorming with Anne about how we could bring more women to the table in our studio. The conversation eventually turned into She Is the Music, a nonprofit I co-founded in 2018. I and three other industry leaders, Anne Mincielli, sound engineer and founder of Jungle City Studios, Jody Gershon, CEO and chairperson of Universal Music Publishing Group, and Samantha Kirby-Yo, WME partner and head of the East Coast Music Department, were the crew of original visionaries, but we've now brought together about 100 women leaders across our industry. That number is still growing, which is the point. Together, we are creating opportunities for women to break in at every level of the music world, from choreographers and lighting designers to engineers, lawyers, stagehands, and producers. There's also mentorship, including an all-female writing camp. It's our way of erasing pay and power disparities by lifting women into key decision-making roles. When you're in a position to hire people, as Anne and I are, you have a responsibility to hire and promote those intent on elevating women. That notion is part of what sparked the idea for She Is the Music. In summer 2018, after I had a powerful phone call with Rosario Dawson about how we could all band together for change, America and I linked up again, this time to stand on behalf of immigrant families under attack at our borders following the president's zero-tolerance policy. More than 3,000 children were forcibly wrenched from their parents' arms. Even now, scores of those children have not been reunited with parents who are locked away in U.S. immigration detention centers. I took one look into the eyes of my own precious children and made a call to America. "What can we do about this?" I asked her. At 6 a.m. on the day of the Families Belong Together rally, she and I, along with Egypt and my brother Cole, boarded an Acela train from New York Penn Station to the nation's capital. In more than 700 cities across the nation, tens of thousands of demonstrators joined voices in a plea for the administration to end its cruel policy. "My 7-year-old son is here with me today," I told the crowd. "His name is Egypt. I couldn't even imagine not being able to find him. I couldn't even imagine being separated from him or scared about how he is being treated. Our democracy is at stake. Our humanity is at stake. We are out here to save the soul of our nation. We need all the children reunited with their parents. We demand to end the zero humanity policy." There is power in sisterhood. Our voices are strongest as part of a chorus, and there are many ways we can come together around issues we care about. These days, I'm dreaming of a fellowship of crusaders, a community of like-minded influencers who stay in constant dialogue and action. Action, that's the key word. Marching has its place, and we should continue to flood the streets and the National Mall. Yet, I'm also looking for ways to turn our protests into meaningful policy change. Time's up for just talking. Game on for flipping the script. Chapter 18, Homeland.
Hello, this is Kasim Dean, aka Swiss Beats. Alicia's first trip to Egypt was a retreat, a way to slow down, catch her breath, reevaluate some things. The second trip was a real pilgrimage. Sometimes you have to be at a certain point in life to truly see a place. I know people who've been around the world but never fully experienced it or learned anything about the culture. This trip was all about learning. Months before we left, Alicia did a lot of homework, a lot of research and studying. We both wanted to go there for the uncut knowledge, the authentic vibes. Since Alicia and I have been together, she's always been on a spiritual journey. She's open-minded. She has wondered about many different religions, Christianity, Buddhism, Islam, and others. She respects all of these beliefs and sees wisdom in them. I think our trip brought her closer to her own relationship with the Most High, outside of any one religion. I see her looking inside of herself for answers. I see her listening to her own spirit, and more I see her moving closer to the truth of who she really is.
The first time I traveled to Egypt, I went in search of solitude. 12 years later, when I returned with my family, I found a part of my identity I hadn't known was missing. My journey back to the motherland began a whole year before the flight was booked. And in a way, it began a lot earlier than that. Since becoming a mother, I've been intent on teaching my children about the heroes that built our country. I want them to know about Frederick Douglass, the prominent abolitionist who used the power of the pen to tell his own story. I want them to celebrate the brilliance of scholar W.E.B. Du Bois and the bravery of Sojourner Truth, the freedom fighter who once asked, "Ain't I a woman?" I want them to know the courage it took for Harriet Tubman to lead families through swamps and darkness toward freedom's fresh air. But before I can tell those stories, before I can explain what enslavement is, I first want to teach them their African ancestry, the extraordinary kingdoms they come from. One afternoon in 2017, when my son asked me a question, it became clear I needed to step up my lesson plans. "Mom," Egypt said as I drove him to school, "what's the N-word?" I swallowed hard and tried to keep a straight face. I'd known this question was coming at some point. I just hadn't expected that point to be age 7. "How did you hear that word, babe?" I asked. "My friend said it," he told me. "Oh, yeah?" I said, "which friend?" He didn't answer. "You can tell me," I said, sensing his hesitation. "It's cool." He explained that a girl in his class had said it that day. She hadn't directed it at him, he said, nor had she used the actual word. "So what does it mean?" he asked again. "It's a word we don't use," I told him, "and it's a mean word that has been used about people of color. That's why we don't use it." After that conversation, I got focused. For years, I've been frustrated with how history is taught and isn't taught in American schools. The introduction of black people is presented in the context of enslavement, the word I use in place of the dehumanizing term slave. I don't believe in the word slave because no one chooses to be owned by someone. An enslaved person is a human being whose freedom has been stolen. As I've raised my own consciousness through reading and studying, I've become intentional about properly framing our story for my children. More than anything, I want them to understand their true identity, who our people were before 400 years of bondage. I want them to know the strength of our ancestors' spirits, and I want them to hear that story in a way that makes them feel empowered rather than victimized. My brain went into overdrive after Egypt's question. How do I talk to him about enslavement in a way that doesn't emasculate him? After some thought, I landed on an approach. I'd share with him the many moments in history when people of various backgrounds have suffered unimaginable cruelty and death at the hands of others, like the Holocaust. Sadly, the list is long. I first shared with Egypt the many amazing innovations of the ancient Nile River Valley civilizations, from creating a complex planetary system that became the basis for current-day astronomy, to inventing an ingenious farming and agricultural practice that allowed them to grow large crops. "That's me, Mommy," he'd say, connecting his name with the greatness I told him about. "Yes, that's you," I said. Then in one conversation at a time, over the next several weeks, I slowly introduced him to the ideas of war and genocide. I began by focusing on the abuse of refugees and indigenous groups before moving on to the Holocaust. Finally, one afternoon, just after Egypt had excitedly returned home with a bucket of minnows he'd caught at a little brook nearby, I sat down with him for the last talk in the series. "You remember how you asked me that question about the N-word?" I said. He looked at me, nodded, and then returned his attention to the fish swirling around in his bucket. "Look, Mommy," he said, pointing at the minnows. I pulled him close to me. "Babe, I need you to pay attention right now so we can have a big boy conversation," I said. "And I think you're ready for this talk because you're thoughtful and responsible. Do you think you can handle it?" His eyes widened. "Yes," he said. His expression turned serious. In the most gentle voice I could muster, I reminded him again of our ancestors' amazing legacy. I then explained in simple terms that there had been many wars throughout history. I told him that mothers and fathers and children were sometimes captured and separated from one another. Some were even sold to other people. "That is called enslavement," I said slowly, "and it's terrible. And it's wrong. No person owns another person." I gave him a few examples of the cruelty we'd talked about in our earlier conversations, and I wasn't sure he was grasping the idea. But his eyes lit up when I said this. "Sometimes the people who were captured weren't allowed to read or write." He gasped. "Really?" he said. That clicked. As the book lover my son is, he couldn't imagine that anyone wouldn't be allowed to do something he does every day, read. The conditions were very unfair, I said. I was going to leave the conversation at that, but then he said, Mommy, you didn't answer the question. What's the N-word? I paused. You know how you've been learning the word black in Spanish? I said. One of his sitters, Miss Kiki, who speaks Spanish, had been teaching him the language. Yes, he said, it's negro. Well, in Latin, it's Niger, I told him. And from those two languages, the N-word became a hate word. He stared at me. How do you spell the N-word? He said. I spoke each letter slowly. So that was the unkind word used against our ancestors, I said. And unfortunately, you're going to hear that word a lot as you grow up. That's why I want you to understand the reason we don't use it. At one point in my life, I did use the word, starting when I was around 16 up until I was 20. One of my first songs ever released was Girlfriend, which samples Old Dirty Bastard's Brooklyn Zoo. Near the end, I sang the word I now detest. It's enough to make a go crazy. At that time, in the privacy of a studio when I was creating that song,